Hello, everybody. First, we want to congratulate everyone who successfully set their clock forward. We want to apologize to any of you who didn't and are now at the wrong panel, having missed the one that you really wanted to go to. We'll try to make it up to you, but I can't guarantee it. Hi, I'm Will Schwalbe.
And I'm David Shipley. And I have been asked to make clear that this is being recorded for the free podcast on southbysouthwest.com. The name of the panel is I Can't Believe I Sent That. So we're here to talk about a question that's not strictly technological. It's more emotional or anthropological or psychological. It's why we manage to screw up on email so much. Why, years after it's become a mainstream, run-of-the-mill, everyday, commonplace thing, we still mess up. And we're not just talking about stupid people doing stupid things. That will happen regardless of the medium. It happened on parchment. It happened over the phone. It happened with chalk on cave walls. We're talking about people who should know better. Business titans who insider trade on email. Government officials who say damning things on email. Space shuttle pilots who carry out their romantic correspondences on email. We've found that as we've been asking this question, it sparked great conversations. And so this morning, we're going to talk a little about our time exploring language and mishaps on email. And then we'll open the floor to conversation. But first, we have a brief instructional video. And I advise you to pay special attention to the section on hygiene.
What I hate about email, the first thing that definitely comes to mind would be all the emails I get from Viagra and other sexual enhancement companies.
I like email because I hate the phone and I hate having to deal with actual people.
Oh, the smiley things, the little smiley faces. Oh, that's annoying. The smiley things is... Oh.
Stupid jokes. That drives me insane. One of those, like, forward this to, like, 10 people or 2 million people will die somewhere or something crazy like that. I'm just like, dude, come on.
You can be in touch with people from all around the world in a split second. And that is incredible. You know, you send off an email and it's instantly gratifying.
The thing I love about emails is that it's efficient. Like you can connect with, you know, 10 to 20 people at the same time.
I'm better about my emails than I am about my cell phone, actually. I mean, emails are actually the easiest way to get in touch with me.
You have to end a relationship, you don't have the balls to do it on the phone.
End a relationship.
Just type that out.
Lots of experience with that.
Learn an app by email. The quicker you get the information, the better your life will be. And maybe that's the kind of secondary information that only email can deliver.
I happen to be dating someone right now who, like, just fires off these one-liner emails, like, as his response. Like, he's never written me an email that's more than 2 lines long. And I really feel like it's a communication. Like, I want people to take their time and write and, you know. I mean, it's different if you're just making plans or something.
I hate when people do not respond to an email, when they don't respond to it or they ignore it or they don't respond to it in a timely fashion. Because to me, if I email you with a question, I want a response. And I consider email another form of dialogue or conversation. And if I was talking to you live and you just didn't respond and walked away, that to me would be equatable with not responding to an email. I just think it's rude and it's poor etiquette. So I hate poor email etiquette.
A lot of times people send emails just to show that they are proactive. But that does not necessarily mean that they are really proactive. I think sometimes emails can crisis makers.
You get this 25 paragraph email and you look at it and you say, damn, I gotta read this? I gotta read this whole thing? It's gonna take me a half hour to read. Just get to the point.
My freshman year in baseball, when I hadn't come to terms with how to use email to the fullest extent, I actually, there's two different lines of emails that go out. One to the coach and the entire team, and one to just the entire team. And I said some not some nice stuff about the coach in an email that was supposed to be to one of my friends, but ended up actually going to the coach. So that wasn't very good. But luckily the coach he stepped down the next year, so I didn't have to deal with it.
I manage a group of guys, and there was a time when I got an email from my immediate supervisor asking me to can three of the guys that I managed. And it really was just like, they're not performing, can them, and that was it. It was a very cold, impersonal sort of command, you know, like off with their heads, and it was like sent off, and I was like, wow, that sucks. Maybe you could have talked to me and figured it out and at least discussed. Because I got to tell this person you're out of a job, but I don't really have any kind of like reasons to give them or anything like that. I'm just like, yeah, I got an email, you're out, see you, bye. So that was terrible. I thought that was kind of like really awful. And again, that goes back to the fact that you can't really emote in an email. You can't really show any kind of compassion, happiness, or anything like that. It's just, do this, or hey, there's nothing in there. It's very dry. It's like IM or MSN. It, you know, it's good for a while, but for some things, I still think you need that human touch, the voice, or the face, or whatever.
Here. Send. Okay.
Thank you. As you can probably guess, that was real people filmed in New York City. Real people who signed legal releases, I should add. All of them made clear that email was part of their lives. All of them made clear that they couldn't live without email, and yet none of them expressed confidence in their ability to email effectively in every situation. Now, we know that email is no longer the dominant form of social communication for many people, but it's still the dominant form of electronic business communication around the world, and it's still an important form of social communication. So when you screw up, what is at stake is everything from your friendships to your career. These fears that we were hearing from people...
Do you have anything, any embarrassment?
What? These fears that we were hearing from people and that we were feeling ourselves, that we were screwing up too much on email, the realization that we were spending way too much time divining the meaning of bad emails, prompted us to embark on a kind of electronic odyssey. We both email a lot for work, and I don't think we're out of the ordinary, certainly among all of you. Last year, according to our programs, we each received about 50,000 emails through work and sent 30,000 or so. Like we said, not out of the ordinary, but enough for any brain. So Dave and I were having lunch one day, and we were complaining. And what we were complaining about was how badly our mornings that particular day had sucked. We quickly realized that just about everything that had gone wrong had to do with crappy emails that we had either sent or been sent. So that's why we set ourselves this task, to figure out why so many of us email so badly and how to do it better. So we weren't just trying to understand disastrous emails like the ones that Michael Brown, the FEMA director, sent. Remember during the worst days of Katrina, he sent an email that said, "Am I a fashion god?" and was arranging for a dog sitter. We were looking for insight into the everyday screw-ups. Emails that are too formal or too casual, too angry or too sarcastic, too vague or just unnecessary. These are the sins we most often commit and the ones that are most often committed against us.
We brought an example from our files, but we needn't volunteer. No shots and no humiliation. And Kevin, would you be kind enough to, how about you?
That would be great.
Perfect. So,
no one can hear me on this device. Thank you.
Kevin, welcome for the podcast people. So one day we received an email from our editor. We'll call him Marty. That's his name. And the email, which will be rendered by Kevin, went like this. Card number one, please.
One for the book.
So that was the subject line. So the body of the email contained an anecdote of a mortifying exchange that Marty had had with a colleague. So how did we respond? I took the email at face value. and simply thanked Marty for the note and wrote, "Dear Marty, thanks for the anecdote. This will fit right in. All best, David." And I copied Will on my answer, but he had a very different reaction to Marty's email.
See, what I thought Marty was doing by sending this little contribution was really asking us for a progress report. I thought this was his subtle way of reminding us, without pushing explicitly, that he was out there waiting for us to give him something. I thought it was a kind of, hello, remember me, and the appropriate and expected reply was one from us letting him know how close we were to delivering the manuscript. So I started to compose a reply.
And as it turned out, as it so often does, Will was absolutely right.
Thank you.
Because before we could formulate a reply, we received another email from Marty, and this one said, in part, "Kevin, please, card number 2.
I would love to see a portion of the manuscript to show my colleagues at an upcoming meeting."
Ah, so what did we do? Well, we behaved like absolute lunatics. We panicked, and then we did nothing, and then days went by, and finally, we composed the following travesty of an email. Subject, one for the book. 2, Marty, from Shipley Schwalbe. "Dear Marty," it read, "thanks so much for yours. The writing is going well, but we're not quite there yet. We really want to get you something for your upcoming meeting, but we are not totally sure we can do it in time. We're wondering how much of the manuscript you need and the last date we can get it to you. Is there a part of the manuscript you're particularly interested in having? We have a complete first draft," stretching the truth, "but some parts are more polished than others. Perhaps we can talk next week so we can let you know where we're at and how best to proceed. All best, Will and David." So that should have cleared everything up, right? Unfortunately not. Here is Marty's reply, again courtesy of Kevin.
"I'm going on vacation next week. Let's talk when I return."
So what exactly did this mean? We're going to now ask Kevin to offer a couple of alternative dramatic readings of the line. So, Kevin, reading number 1, please.
"I'm going on vacation next week. Let's talk when I return."
So, if this was the correct electronic interpretation, Marty was saying that there really wasn't a problem, that, you know, great art takes time, and he was going to go on his holiday, and the creative process would unfold, and so on. There is an alternative reading, and it goes something like this. Kevin?
"I am going on vacation next week. Let's talk when I return."
So if... Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm getting chills up my spine. So if this was the tone that went with the sentence, then the sentiment was very different. This would mean that Marty was saying he was fed up with us and needed a week's holiday to cool down sufficiently before he could cancel our contract.
This tortured interaction brought us face-to-face with two of email's stealthiest characteristics, both of which are alluded to in the video we saw. First, email is, of course, an affectless medium. It was possible for us to read Marty's email any number of ways. Email's inherent absence of tone encourages misunderstanding. Readers, like us, project all their fears into the simplest of sentences, sometimes with just cause and sometimes without. And second, email can be an enormous time waster because of its ability to simulate forward motion when none is taking place. After all, our long email to Marty was really just meant to buy us time while creating the illusion that we were responding constructively. There's a wonderful quote from Bob Geldof. We know the world recognizes this man for "I don't like Mondays" and "Do they know it's Christmas?" But we think he should be known for this bit of wisdom. Email is dangerous because it gives us a feeling of action even when nothing is happening. Now, the point of our boring little story is exactly that. It's not a catastrophe. No animals were injured. No people were hurt. Nothing was broken. No one lost their job, a friend, or their cool. But there's a toll to this kind of bad emailing, and the toll is our time and energy, and those are two pretty valuable commodities. So before tackling how we can all email better, we decided to try to pinpoint the causes of bad email, and we boiled it down to 6 reasons. First is the curse of the new. Now, many of you have been emailing for a good long while now, but in terms of human history, email is brand new. And like all toys, once we get it, once we unwrap it Christmas morning, we tend to use it too much. And we use it inappropriately, like to fire people. Here's the verbatim text of how one young woman was fired electronically. We've reviewed your sales figures, and they're really not up to the level we need. As a result, we will not require your services anymore. Thank you for your time with us. Nice. That was a text message sent to her cell phone. Radio Shack did the same thing when it sent the following email to 400 people right here in Texas. The email read, "The workforce reduction notification is currently in progress. Unfortunately, your position is one that has been eliminated." Nice. So that's the first thing. Bad email happens when you use email for something that should have been done in person. Second, as we mentioned earlier, if you don't consciously insert tone into an email, a kind of universal default tone won't automatically be conveyed. People forget this. For this reason, email demands that we figure out who we are in relation to the person we're writing and that we adjust the tone accordingly. Something that's confusing and hard to remember with technology that flattens the world, breaks down hierarchies, and makes everyone available. Now, just the other day, opened my inbox, and I got a long, chatty email, and it was addressed to my nearest, dearest, and queerest. This email, which could have easily come from one of my friends, didn't. It came from a job applicant. Apparently, my name had found its way onto one of his lists, or it was an autofill error, and what I got was an email that described his recent vacation, and it had enormous detail devoted to his boyfriend's enormous... Well, you get the point. I won't go any further. But he's an excellent writer. It was very entertainment reading. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And so, you know, of course, I didn't really mind. But in the end, I'll never really know whether the flatness of email convinced him that he and I were perhaps on chummier terms than we were, or whether it was just a garden variety oops. Third, email is fast, often too fast to keep up with. And yet, as we mentioned in terms of volume, we're in the position of having to get our messages right, tone, content, spelling, dozens or even hundreds of times a day and under intense pressure. What's more, email's reach means that people who didn't necessarily have to write now have to put their ideas and thoughts and responses down in words, words you then have to decipher. Speed encourages sloppiness, and that in turn causes problems because words, no matter how we use them, carry meaning. Now, a friend of ours was recently embroiled in this intense office flame war, and it was causing a huge problem with productivity because everybody was just spending all day composing really nasty messages to each other. She stepped in offline, she talked to everybody, she got it all sorted out, everything was all calm, and then she sent one final email saying, "Are there any problems remaining in this matter?" Great. One person wrote back, and they meant to write, "No, period, thanks to you." You can see where this is going. The period didn't quite make it in. The email was CC'd to everyone. It said, "No thanks to you." The office erupted in more email flame wars, and it was weeks before it all calmed down.
Number four. In face-to-face or voice-to-voice conversation, our emotional brains are constantly monitoring the reactions of the person to whom we are speaking. Email really offers no real-time channel for that kind of feedback. And unfortunately, the technology somehow lulls us into thinking that such a channel actually exists. There are studies to prove this. Dan Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence, told us that email puts people, in neurological terms, in a state of disinhibition, or in our terms, cluelessness. He actually wrote a much-emailed article about this in Science Times, the New York Times, a couple of weeks ago. When we're on email, the inhibiting circuits in our brain, those that shut up before you say something really stupid circuits, have checked out. Fifth, email doesn't just make it easier for us to lose our cool. It eggs us on. On email, people aren't quite themselves. They're angrier, less sympathetic, less aware, more easily wounded, even more gossipy and duplicitous. Email has a tendency to encourage the lesser angels of our nature. Combined with this, with the easy to hit send key, and you have a problem. Interestingly, a study was brought to our attention in an article by Dan Gilbert, who spoke here last year. Here's what he wrote. At a university college in London, pairs of volunteers were hooked up to a mechanical device that allowed each of them to exert pressure on the other volunteer's fingers. The researcher began the game by exerting a fixed amount of pressure on the first volunteer's finger. The first volunteer was then asked to exert precisely the same amount of pressure on the second volunteer's finger. The second volunteer was then asked to exert the same amount of pressure on the first volunteer's finger, and so on. The two volunteers took turns applying equal amounts of pressure to each other's fingers, while the researchers measured the actual amounts of pressure applied. The results were striking. Although volunteers tried to respond to each other's touches with equal force, they typically responded with about 40% more force than they had just experienced. Each time a volunteer was touched, he touched back harder, which led the other volunteer to touch back even harder. This despite the fact that each volunteer was convinced that he was responding with equal force and that for some reason the other person was escalating. Sound familiar? Sound like a flame war? Sixth, what works in speech and even in letters comes out very differently on email. Here's just one quick example of how things can go awry. Take the word please, one of the nicest, most polite words in the English language. Now, common sense would tell you that adding please to an email will always make it more polite. And common sense would also be wrong. A spoken please is considerate. An email please can come across as hectoring. Would you please remember to include me on the email whenever you respond to him? Conveys a sense of exasperation. You've been told this before. It says, why can't you get it right? Strangely, we found universal agreement that the abbreviation PLS, P-L-S, period, doesn't seem to convey that frosty tone, although obviously it can be used only in informal communication. So those are the whys. We also found a set of ways we email badly. And to begin with, there are, of course, mistakes like these.
Embarrassing thing that you've ever
done with email? Yes. Yeah. So, it's so awful. It's the most awful thing that's ever happened to me. So, here at work, I manage this mailing list for this campaign that we do to try to overturn a section of the Patriot Act. And that mailing list contains probably, at the time, it probably contained about 38,000 people. and we got this new, like, mass mailing software to use so that we could send out, you know, one message to everyone, like, just with the click of a button instead of sending out, like, batches of hundreds, and it would take forever. So this was really great. So we got the software. I put it on my computer. I'm trying it out. And of course, like, in typical form, I don't really read the directions or anything. I'm kind of like, oh, I'll just figure it out. You know, it's just easy email software. So I send out this test message to Anna and Larry, who are my cohorts here, that is basically just like a joke message saying, saying we are all liberal weenies, because there are a lot of people on our email list who are like kind of hate how liberal we are. There's sort of a lot of like libertarians and conservatives who have the common interest of wanting to overturn a lot of the Patriot Act, but don't necessarily share our politics. So it was just a kind of joking around message to make sure that it worked. I sent it to them. I went home, and then the next day I get in, and it turns out that message has gone out to all 38,000 people on the mailing list, and probably like 200 people have written back with total confusion, saying, "What the hell is this? Like, what is this message? Is there some kind of mistake?" I said something like, "Hope you all get this. Like, click here if this works." And of course, the links don't work because it's a joke message and whatever. So then I had to send out all these sort of people. Oh, and it turned out that people thought that like we'd been hacked or something, which was great. Like, they didn't actually think that we the system had been hacked, and the you know, some hacker sent out some fake message. So that was good. And actually, it turned out that most people were pretty understanding when I sent out an apology message. But literally, I came in and I saw that this had happened. I don't think you were here, were you? I don't know.
I don't know where I was, but...
But I came in, I saw that it had happened, and I wept. Like, I wept. Openly. And I just felt like I wanted to get up and leave this office and never come back ever again. So that was the worst thing. And then from then on, I had like email fear. Like I couldn't send out an email to more than one person without being afraid of like what was going to happen. I was traumatized for a very long time, which isn't good because that's sort of my main job here, that I've never
been mailing this. How did you get over it?
I think just time and laughing about it and the fact that nobody actually really got mad at me. Like my boss thought it was the funniest thing that had ever happened. And I don't think that my boss, Mike, knew about it, actually, until the other night when I brought it up. But now I just think it's funny. But it was really, like, the most traumatizing thing.
That's Bridget, our pal. Okay, so we've all done something along those lines, and I wish I had some great word of wisdom for you, but the real lesson is try not to do that. There are more vexing traps, though, ones that within our control. We're going to run through them quickly, then we're going to sort of interrupt our scheduled program so we can have some conversation, and if there's more time at the end, we'll come back to the rest of what we were going to say. But we're going to quickly run through what we call the 8 deadly sins of email. Oh, and by the way, I know I love to number things. I know this is like the 3rd numbered list that we've had in this, and it's the OCD acting up again, and I really apologize. And I'm trying really hard not to count the number of people in the audience and divide it by 5, but I'll try to keep that under control. Okay, so the 8 deadly sins, the big 8. First deadly sin, the email that's unbelievably vague. This would be an email like, "Where's Dave?" What does this mean? David Thomas, or David Tom, or my cousin Dave in New York? And what do you want him for? Do you want to talk to him? Is it urgent? Should he call you or text you or come find you? And if so, where are you? Or are you just curious, no action needed? That simple question, when posed on email, can eat up 6 or 7 rounds. Now imagine it was addressed not just to me, but to a few people. So not only is one person not sure what to do, many are, and they're not even sure who's supposed to be doing or not doing whatever it is they're supposed to be doing. Maddening. Second deadly sin. The email that insults you so badly you have to get up from your desk. This happens a lot. Here's one email a friend of ours, a well-known figure in the publishing world, received from a famous celebrity. We'll call our friend Anne. David really wanted to read this.
Will got to read it every other time, so I just wanted to... Anne. From what planet do you reside? Do you intentionally act ignorant to your own manufacture of reality? How can you be entitled to anything when you have no contract, in caps, with me? Is your job in jeopardy? Is your firm's financial position at such an all-time low that there's a need to leech off me yet again? Do the words bad business practices even remotely reach some level of your intelligence? Comma, ethics, question mark. For a very long time, I've wondered just what it was that upset me regarding my dealings with your firm. I finally realized it via your email. Presumptuous, exclamation mark. Do you know what the word means, question mark? Please refrain from contacting me again directly, period. Thank you for letting me do this.
Oh, sure. I know, it's fun. So, and of course, that didn't just go to our friend Anne. It went to a whole host of people with CCs and probably BCCs, too. So remember what Dan Goleman had to say. We could really go on all morning about just the subject of rhetorical questions and how much worse they make things, but we won't do that. We'll go back to our list. The third deadly sin, the email that's cowardly. Email encourages cowardice. You can drop bombs, do and say horrible things, fire 400 employees around Texas, like we mentioned, all while safely shielded by your terminal. Oh, and emoticons do not soften the blow. But probably most cowardly are emails that are more garden variety. That really bad piece of news, just send it Friday afternoon. That way, you can not only ruin someone's entire weekend, but you can ensure that you won't have to deal with the problem for a couple of days if you make yourself unavailable. Also cowardly, and we've all been guilty of this, when you forward someone else's moronic email to another friend with the snarky comment attached. Now, in a classic karma is a beautiful thing kind of a way, this is exactly the kind of email you're most likely to accidentally send back to the person who you're being so mocking of.
So our fourth deadly sin is the email that puts you in jail. As we said earlier, even really intelligent people seem to forget that email is permanent and searchable, which means that it's probably best to follow the maxim set forth by New York's governor, Eliot Spitzer, who wrote when he was attorney general about email, "Never talk when you can nod, and never write when you can talk. My only addendum is never put it in an email." This is still news to a lot of people, we fear. Here are some actual emails that have wound up in court, put people in jail, and cost companies lots of money. Did we get this illegal stuff about withholding expenses and retirement money worked out? Can we get away with it? Delete this email. This might not be legal. And one of our favorites, this was sent by an employee at A.H. Robbins, the maker of Fen-Phen, which turned out to have horrible and fatal side effects. Do I have to look forward to spending my waning years writing checks to fat people worried about a silly lung problem? The fifth deadly sin, the email that won't go away. We'll make this simple. You can and should thank someone for a favor. They can thank you for your thank you, but you can't thank them for their thank you for your thank you. The madness has to stop. And so be a force for good. Sixth, there is a special circle of hell for people who send sarcastic emails. But one of the dangers of the sarcastic email is that people don't recognize them as such. In a study at Cornell, it was discovered that even when students tried to be drippingly sarcastic on emails and sent those drippingly sarcastic emails to other students, the sarcasm was only correctly interpreted 87% of the time. A final word on sarcasm. It comes from the Greek word for ripping flesh with your teeth. So I think that drives the point home.
And getting near the end of the list, the seventh is the email that is too casual. For example, my name's Will. I'm not Willie, Bill, Billy, the Willster. But that all seems to arrive. Now, interestingly, we've been conducting a totally unscientific survey of South by Southwest Interactive participants, asking them the question, what is their biggest pet peeve about email? And the biggest, in fact, it was almost unanimous, are emails that are too casual. People here really get irritated when they receive emails without proper subject lines, when they receive emails without greetings, without proper sign-offs, when they receive ungrammatical, badly spelled emails. That seems to be what infuriates everyone the most. And when I've told people who've answered that question, people seem surprised that it was so unanimous among South by Southwest Interactive people. So for what it's worth, we thought that was interesting. Lynn Truss, the author of Eat, Shoots, and Leaves, would be very pleased. And finally, before we open it up, the eighth deadly sin is the inappropriate email. When a company called Inboxer, and that's not a strong enough word, as you'll see. When a company called Inboxer did a study of the Enron email archive, which had been made available for the lawsuit, they found that 4% of all messages sent by Enron employees were racist, sexist, pornographic, homophobic, or otherwise offensive. It seems we've turned into a nation of trigger-happy shock jocks. Of course, sending offensive emails can get you fired, and we think that's a good thing. So, okay, so there are lesser sins. I'll quickly mention a few of them. Subject lines, they should live up to their billing. Great news should be great, otherwise it can be deflating. Contrast, great news, I just remembered the name of that cereal I loved as a kid with great news, Yahoo wants to buy us out. And I have to mention the sucker punch subject line. This is a real email that came to me from my HR department. The subject line in capital letters said, Memorial Day weekend holiday, exclamation, exclamation, exclamation. And it came the Thursday before Memorial Day weekend, which was so exciting. And then I opened the email, and it said, the Friday before Memorial Day weekend is a full working day. If you take this as a holiday, you will be docked a vacation day. Thanks a lot. So some of the minor transgressions that also people have been talking about. Personal spam. All your friends do not want emails chock full of JPEGs. For God's sakes, get a blog. Vague or wrong or missing subject lines. That kind of thing. But we aren't just interested in what makes bad email. We're interested in what makes good email. So here's a brief list of the qualities we like. We love exclamation points. We actually really like emoticons, ironic used or not. We like furious emails when it's justified. Sometimes you really should send that. Just think before you do it. We love short paragraphs. If there's a request, we want it clear and at the top. We really like top posting and not bottom posting. We don't like to play hide and seek to find your response. We love simple fonts. We do not like wallpaper. We like one person in the to line. We like when you let people know that no reply is needed. And we're even cool with condolence notes or thank you notes by email so you can get them to people swiftly so long as you mention a proper note is coming and you really send one. And what else do we like? We like flag-free emails, please. We don't like to be told what's urgent. We like to decide that all by ourselves.
But in truth, you know, in the end, it does come down to certain mindfulness. And as antiquated as it may seem, an adherence to the golden rule. I work at the Times op-ed page, and we get a lot of submissions from many different people every day. And last year, I walked into my office, and I logged on, and I found this email from the communications director to a famous politician who right now is a sort of a quasi-presidential candidate. And it read, David, I need to know what happened to famous politician's piece. Why did it not run? We were clear you said to me that it was to run the next day or the day after I sent it. This is most unusual that you would solicit a piece from famous politician's name withheld, say that you liked it, told me it would run, and then never does. Best regards, communications director to famous politician. Now, the problem was I couldn't remember anything about the piece in question. And after fully absorbing the email, I spent the better part of the morning searching the op-ed inventory and hounding my colleagues and wondering whether we had in fact accepted an article from this famous politician and I was somehow experiencing some form of middle-aged memory loss. When no one could remember, I felt I had to address the problem head-on. And so I sent an email to the communications director, apologizing if there had been any mix-up and asking him to send the piece again. A short while later, probably half an hour later, I received a curt reply. The reason I hadn't been able to find the piece was that it had been solicited by and submitted to another newspaper's opinion page. In other words, the communications director had been completely in the wrong. Thinking about it now, it really is still hard to imagine a more satisfying moment. Because here was a chance to write just a wonderfully withering email. I mean, this is what email is for, right? There was a trail that proved my utter absolute rightness. There was ample time, I mean, just oodles of time to compose the perfect razor-sharp riposte. There was even the opportunity to CC several people and maybe BCC a few others. And so what did I do? Well, in this instance, not in every instance, the better angels of my nature took over. And somehow I managed to send a don't worry about it email back to this guy. Believe me, I have not always acted this nobly. But we've all had opportunities to rub people's noses in their email errors. But we've also been in the shoes of this communications director.
So we know there's a lot of talk about whether email is here to stay or not, whether it's a durable communication medium that will be with us forever or already obsolete. We feel it's an incredibly useful form of communication and hope it sticks around. But whether it does or doesn't, to some degree, depends on us. The less annoying we make our own emails, the more people will look forward to going through their inbox and replying, and the more we'll continue to email each other instead of using another form. So here's our final plea to everyone. Let's all cut one another slack. Email's too fluid and is evolving too rapidly for there to be style police, and etiquette is situational. But let's not cut too much slack, especially when it comes to our own behavior. It's within our reach as senders and responders to exercise greater mindfulness and awareness of what we're doing. And when we're more thoughtful and careful, it's incredible the effect we can have on our own lives. Fewer people are mad at us, we get more done, and we can look forward to opening our email. We're going to leave you with three things. Two maxims. Sorry, I did it again. The OCD. Yeah. Think before you send. Send emails you'd like to receive. And the third, please come visit our website and post your worst email stories. Thank you. Now, we'd love to hear from people, your thoughts on email, your terrible email stories, disagreeing with us, anything. And please come up to one of the mics. There we go.
Yes, I have a question.
Oh, I think we do a line at the mic? Great.
Recently, I got into a situation where there was probably going to be some legal action taken, either on my part or someone else's part. And I documented the entire situation through emails, because that's really the only communication I had up until the point where I actually mailed them a certified letter, which they didn't even actually receive. So I'm wondering, I mean, at what point can I take all my printed out emails or something and use those in court? Or is there just, I mean, I can create as many emails as I want.
Yeah, the law's sort of in flux about this, but as near as our understanding of it at the moment is that unless the emails are harvested professionally off the server, they may not hold up in court. So there has to be a legal process for that, because, of course, anybody can sit around and make up things that look like emails. The other thing is that unless you work in an industry where you've decided in advance that an email agreement is binding, an email agreement is probably not binding. But it's all in flux, and it's being litigated like crazy.
Okay. I have another quick question. I've heard a little bit about Operation Inbox Zero or something like that, and I was kind of intrigued that it seems in the future that everything may be based, your inbox may be based on a batch situation where it seems in my industry, which I do a lot of designed emails and such, where the subject line would then determine where in my inbox it would be filtered to, which would allow me to then kind of go at it when I want to. Have you guys heard anything about that, or how far are we away from having an inbox?
I think there's probably people in this room who know much more about that than we do. So maybe if someone could join the line and fill everybody in on that, that would be great.
This is very much related to that. Hi, Will. Steve Hanselman says hi, by the way. The question is more about controlling the quantity of emails. So I was just thumbing through the book and saw a note on how Bill Gates does that. And I was curious, since the sheer volume, an increasing volume of not just completely unimportant, but minimally important email is so vast, what have the two of you found to be the most effective way of decreasing the amount of email you actually have to respond to personally?
I use mailboxes, and I just filter through different mailboxes, and I have sort of a mailbox hierarchy. It's a rising tide, and I think everybody has to devise their own response to that, especially because all the different programs are so different. I mean, Lotus will let you do one thing, Eudora will let you do another. Everybody has a different, I mean, that's the interesting thing about it, is everybody has a different mind mechanism for figuring out how they make sense of this flood.
I have a trick that I picked up from Lawrence Lessig in Wired magazine, which is taking your email, your box to zero by pasting everyone's address into one thing, saying, I'm hopelessly behind, I'm deleting all my emails. If it was important, please hit me up again, and if not, I'm sorry.
do Do either of you have assistants read email, or do you all personally?
I absolutely do not. There's too much confidential stuff, people's salaries, this stuff.
Okay, thank you.
But people do. I think that it seems one of the sort of holy grails now is different, more sophisticated sorting technologies. And I think people are coming at it a lot of different ways. But definitely people, I think, are looking at that.
Well, I have a question, but I'll start with a horror story first.
Great.
I was out of the office for an entire week, you know, not really checking my email. Come back, dealing through everything. And this topic came up, didn't really want to deal with it. Sent a reply, got a message right back. And then she buzzes me. Like, to my office, and starts, like, bugging me before I even read the email. And all I just did was sit there and turn my music off, not to respond. Because it's like, if you sent me an email, let me read it before you start talking to me. The question I have is, how do you tell people politely in email when you don't have other options that they're wrong and not have them, like, get offended, freak out, start this flame war?
I mean, I sort of a big believer, having lived in Asia for years, in saving face. And so my first gambit is always to do the classic, look, it may just be me and I may be confused, but I really, you know, my recollection, fuzzy as it might be, you know, kind of thing. And just give them away, you know, if you start by not, you know, shoving the face in the dirt, there's more of a chance. But some people just won't take that. And sometimes it's like the Band-Aid pull. It's if that's not working, I think a brief email that just tells it like it is. But I think one of the things we talk about a lot amongst each ourselves is consistency. So if you are a very abrupt person, you can get away with abrupt emails among people who know you. But if you tend to be more baroque and loquacious, you have to do that on email too. Otherwise, people will get insulted.
It's interesting. I received an email of We have a mutual friend, or Will has a very close friend, who's a noted playwright, who is noted for sending very energetic emails.
Larry Kramer, if anybody knows Larry, yeah.
and sometimes these emails can be pretty harsh. And I got one a couple weeks ago about something that we'd run on the op-ed page, basically saying, you know, David, you're an absolute idiot. I have no idea why you have this job. I can't believe the garbage that you're putting on the op-ed page. You know, you might as well just open the window and jump out, or, you know, find something meaningful with you. And so I, first thing I did, as I often do these days, is I called Will. And Will said, well, you know, but that's a normal Larry Kramer email. You know, I get emails like that. Calvin Trilling gets emails like that. All these other people get these emails. If he had deviated from the form, then you would have been concerned. Or if you had gotten an email from someone who is noted for their sort of Roger Angel, New Yorker-like polite emails, who was suddenly, you know, coming at you with a howitzer, then you would be concerned. So Will gave me great advice in that situation, that it is sort of personally contextual.
I have two comments. The first is, I think a lot of the responsibility lies with people who make email software, because it encourages a lot of really bad habits. Outlook, for example, maybe if you try and send a message with no subject line, it should say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you do that.
Yeah.
And I don't need to see re. It should say, oh, well, I only need one re. I'm going to fix those for you. And it should be big R, little e, you know, because then the other email software doesn't match up. Then if you get a message from someone in Germany and they use a different word for re, and then she'd realize that, otherwise you get this back and forth, and your subject is like way down the line. So, people, if you write email software, if you have friends who write email software, they should spend more time making it so we communicate better and less time so we make pink emails with flashing dots around them. Because
that's a great
point. Don't need that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to applaud. Can I applaud
for
a second?
It's really...
I don't. I use a Mac. I don't use Outlook. But my pet peeve for email is people who don't know how to behave on mailing lists. And I get a lot of email, and I get a lot of mailing lists. And one way that helps me cope with this is get these emailing lists in digest mode. So at the end of the day, I get one long email, and I look through it, and blah, blah, blah. But now, so these can be on various topics, and some are about, you know, hosting concerts. And so I have one level of expectation for the technological skill level of people who host concerts. And I have another level of expectation for people who are interaction designers, right? So I would expect these people to know how to reply to an email, change the subject line when appropriate, quote the appropriate amount of text. But no. And so we get this two-line reply, and then the message before that, and the message before that, and the message before that. And you're scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, and you can't tell where one message ends and the next one begins. And the cognitive load on your brain goes up like this. Now, I don't want to have to think that hard to read your email about, you know, someone's website. So take 3 minutes, look over the email, say, okay, this is going to 100 people or 200 or 500, and if I take 3 minutes, I can save 500 people each 4 minutes of figuring out what I was saying.
Love that. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for the software point.
I may not have been paying attention when you said this, but I can't believe it didn't make your list. It's sending an email to like 20 people trying to schedule a meeting saying I'm available 2 to 3, and then someone replies back, oh, so that we can make the meeting at 3. No, I'm only available between 2 to 3. That's my nightmare, my organization.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, you said you're kind of advocates for email still. I kind of think email is almost over. I think there's just so many great new tools, including IM and other ways to do things, for two reasons. One is like the interruption science behind it and the fact that people are not working because every time their BlackBerry buzzes or their little window pops up with new messages, they stop doing what they were doing. They have to restart. And maybe that's just turning that stuff off, but the interruption science, I'd like to just answer one thing about that. And the second thing is that so much of the email, and I get a couple hundred emails a day that I'm supposed to respond to, most of them, it takes me, as he was saying, so much time to decipher what the person actually means. Are we really accomplishing that much? Wouldn't it be better to either, God forbid, schedule more meetings?
Well, it's interesting. What you said, your first point, a mathematician friend helped us out with this, said that if 10 people are being emailed about 4 restaurants, and you accept that each one's opinion might influence the next one, you can have 1 million emails before you reach conclusion on which restaurant you should go to. And I think I've gotten close there. The point about whether email, I mean, I think that's something that would be, I hope that a lot of people have conversations about it. It's more, we think, what is email really good for? And recognizing that it's actually probably best as an office technology and not a social technology, but that it has some huge advantages over IMing in an office situation, where the searchability of it, the permanence of it, and I know IMs can hang around forever, but the easy permanence of it is a big boon.
Okay, a couple of things. I'll talk fast so I can hit through them. Inbox zero question. Who had the inbox zero question? So 43 folders are the folks who came up with the inbox zero project, which came from getting things done. David Allen system. Everyone knows about that. Yeah. Okay. So, the idea, first of all, is to take, set up rules that get all of your batch stuff off into a folder by itself, on any of your bulk mail, and things that you know are tied to a particular client, particular project, route those. But the biggest thing, there's still a manual process, but the big thing is that inbox is inbox, and it's only a place that you hold stuff until you put it into an appropriate handling bucket. Somebody else made the point about turning off the interruption factor. Hugely important. Turn off the automatic send-receive, and don't let it come in every 10 minutes. Do your send-receive when you're ready to go sit and process email. That's one of the number one productivity things that we found in working on this stuff. Horror story. This happened this week. I had one of my clients sat there and sent me an email and said, why haven't you responded to this? She's been asking you about this all day and you haven't replied. You haven't been around all day, you know, and she needed your help and stuff. And I finally went through and I was like, I haven't even seen this stuff. And I went back through and I finally traced back through this email thread that he had forwarded me. And I realized that it was another contractor who worked with this client. She had a 5-year-old email address for me that was what she had sent. When she had addressed the initial thing to me, and he had replied all, and she had replied all, and she had replied all, and there was 5 rounds of email that had gone on the entire day that I hadn't even seen, and they thought that I was just ignoring it and out of pocket. So, all right.
That's classic. Thank you.
And we've just been told that we have to clear the room in about 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay. Yes?
How can you communicate email etiquette to those people in your office that have absolutely no clue if I go back and I'm at a staff meeting and I start talking about these things, I feel like I'm going to offend some people and look kind of offensive. So are there ways to do that, that nice ways to communicate those?
I think that's, you know, because of the affectless of email, it's got to be done offline. I think like any performance-related issue, finding someone in a good mood, combining it with something positive about their work habits, and then gently steering them. But it's tough. People take it very personally. Good luck.
Hi. I have two parts. One's a horror story, and the second one is something that makes me want to choke my colleagues. I'll start with that one. People think that you'll get it done sooner if you copy in your boss for a simple request.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, hey, John, can you change the time? I'm John, by the way.
Hey, John.
To 5 o'clock for this thing on the calendar. And they copy my boss. And it makes me feel like I'm incompetent. Yeah. Or they think that. And like it makes me not respect them and not want to get it done sooner. So I kind of put it at the end of my list. And then my boss will ask me, like, on Friday, did I do that, even though I got it done, like, 5 days ago? And I just want to be, hey, check out the website before you ask me. And, the horror story is I copied in my IT manager, zero sense of humor, on a poo-poo fetish inside joke that me and another guy have. So,
oh,
I don't like that stuff.
Thanks. I just like to say for the horror story, think very closely before you decide to set up an email listserv for your entire extended family for your father's birthday.
Oh, no.
We had debates over Thanksgiving, the war in Iraq. It got pretty ugly.
Is it still up and running?
It is. Yeah, I finally created a subgroup called Politics at, you know, my family. But my question is, you know, I find that actually email is leading me to pick the phone up more. Because especially when you get to that situation where somebody doesn't understand something, if you can talk to them, a lot of times you can sort of cut to the chase much more quickly. Once you have like created this sort of email nightmare, what are your suggestions for fixing it?
Apologizing. I mean, just as it would be on any medium. I mean, as Will says, direct interaction as unmediated as possible.
Yeah.
But generally not making excuses. I mean, the way that I would apologize to you here if, you know, I had done something, you know, horrific. It works a lot better if I say, you know, I really messed up and I'm sorry. And better in person than on email. But I wish it was sort of a zippier answer. But really what it comes down to is treating people the way you hope that they would treat you.
Real quick, there was actually interesting email tone research done by some guys at University of Chicago recently, and they said that
some guys where?
University of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
That the 53% of the time people actually interpret the email tone correctly, and that 90% of the time we think we interpret it correctly.
Wow.
And the people who are sending it believe that 78% of the time the receiver will receive it correctly. So only most half the time we're actually dead wrong in how we're interpreting the tone of an email.
Well, if you by any chance have a link to that study, it would be
email
if there'd be any way you give it to
us.
Yeah,
it's on Wiki News, so I'll send it to you.
Great.
And I think we probably are allowed to have
one more.
I'll just make it real quick. One, we need better education I'm an ISP, so I have a problem all the time with people sending so much bad emails, you know, jokes and everything else. But one is, like, your book and things like that. Is that online or is it just in book form?
And the book is just in book form, but the web, we have a site up and running.
Okay, so I can send thousands of people there, right?
We would love that. Thank you.
And the one thing is, I think we all rely on email too much. The problem with that is, you know, like the other man said, you know, somebody wants you to do it right now. And, you know, everybody has different schedules and different times and different work hours.
Yeah.
And that's something we need to keep in, you know, this needs to be secondary.
That's a great point. Well, thank you, everybody.
Thank you
very
much.
Do visit us at thinkbeforeyousend.com.
Bye-bye.